We might just as well keep up the old German tradition and start on time. I remember when I was in Munich and the opera started at 8. It didn't start a minute afterwards, it started at 8. And if you weren't there on time, you have to wait for the second act. And if there was only one act, you missed the whole opera. That's the way it goes. I sound kind of mean, but I guess I am. I'm sorry. I may introduce myself. You may want to introduce yourself to your neighbor while I'm doing that. My name is Weber. I teach German at Augustana College. I've been doing that since 1962. And in 1964, I went to East Germany to photograph some of the monuments in East Germany that were left from the days of Martin Luther. Because in first year German, we were reading a little pamphlet dealing with Martin Luther. Now, some of you who have been here before, this may be a repetition, but I'm going to have to beg your indulgence, but there are many of you that weren't here the last time. Last time I spoke was last Saturday. How many were here last Saturday? How many were not here? So I'm going to have to, the others may have to, you know, be a little patient. I'm going to have to review a little bit, but then we'll continue on in depth with 1505. Well, out of these series of slides, developed a picture book because somebody asked me, why don't you write a book on it? And so I said, why not? So I started to write and put these pictures together in earnest, in 1973. And then I took these pictures to the publisher and I said, it's a great idea, but you're not a recognized theologian or a church historian, you're a German teacher. What we need is somebody that's internationally famous. And one thing led to another, and I was introduced to Dr. Ingetraut Ludolfi from the University of Leipzig, who has been a theologian and scholar there for the last quarter of a century, written 8 or 10 books and hundreds of articles in leading journals and encyclopedias. And within 30 days, she wrote the text for these pictures that appear in this book. The idea is to have a picture book. The modern man apparently doesn't have enough time to read, and I thought perhaps if he had a lot of pictures to look at, after he saw them, then he would be inspired to read. It is a minimum of text and a maximum of pictures. And it deals chronologically with the life of Luther and the difficult years of the early church that followed. In other words, 100 years of the Reformation period. Last time we talked about Luther's parents, who were peasants, farmers, had a difficult life. They came south of Erfurt, south of Eisenach, where the Wartburg Castle is, that gained such importance later on in Luther's life. The oldest son, Hans, had to leave the family farm because he was not entitled to inherit it, that was the custom in those days, and he moved on to Eisleben, a city in Saxony. It was a rather free city in Eisleben. He went up there to work as a miner, to earn some money. And that is where Luther then was born on November the 10th, 1483. And his name was not Luther, but Luder. The family name was, even today, is Luder or Luder, and it comes from the German first name Lothar, which means to lead an army. And when you look at the millions of Lutherans today, 75 million of them, he certainly has led quite an army throughout these years. There are about 35 million of them in Europe and about 8 million Lutherans in the United States. He was named Martin because he was baptized on St. Martin's Day. And practically every day of the year is named after a particular saint, and therefore November the 10th would be then, and November the 11th would be the Feast of Saint Martin. The family of Martin found a room. It was not a permanent home. The permanent home of the Luther family was established in nearby Mansfeld. That's where the father worked, and that's where the little boy Martin spent his childhood. And we talked about the strict discipline, we talked about his schooling, we talked about that his father wanted his son to be more than just a miner, a peasant. He wanted him to become a lawyer. He wanted him to earn some money and perhaps in later life take care of his family. He wanted to, his father wanted him to marry into well-to-do family, rich family, and so on. From Mansfeld, then his first schooling, he went on to a better school, and there was an Erfurt, and that was in with the Brothers of the Common Life. We've talked about the difficult life he had at this particular school, because these Brothers of the Common Life led a very strict life of Bible reading and lots of fasting and so on. We talked about how Luther got very, very ill, had a high fever, was not allowed to drink a glass of water, and he went against the rules, crawled out of bed, and drank some water, and otherwise he would have died. We've talked about how he met a prince in this school that had so fasted that he was skin and bones, and shortly thereafter died. A prince that could have led a beautiful secular life, but he gave it all up to live with these Brothers of the Common Life. What were they were trying to do? They were trying to please God and go into heaven. Then from Erfurt, he spent only a year there. The father sent him to relatives in Eisenach, but the relative was a caretaker of a church in Eisenach, which is located today near the Iron Curtain border, and that's also where the Wartburg is and where Johann Sebastian Bach was born. This caretaker could hardly take care of himself, let alone young Martin, and a well-to-do lady in the city of Eisenach heard him sing and saw the piousness of this boy and the devotion he displayed towards God and the church, that she took him into her home and provided him with a real family setting, comfortable, and he has always called Eisenach seine liebe Stadt, his beloved city. In Eisenach, he went to the so-called Gymnasium, which was located at that time. It was in connection with the Church of St. George. And after his Gymnasium, which is the so-called high school, he went on then in 1501 to the University of Erfurt, again pursuing the career of a lawyer. First, he took the regular courses of the liberal arts, which at that time were the sieben freie Künste, the seven arts, so to speak, and they included the trivium, which were courses in grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, as well as the quadrivium, the four courses which included geometry, mathematics, music, and astronomy. So he has followed the wishes of his father. He has upheld the fourth commandment, thou shalt honor father and mother. And then on his trip home, we don't know exactly the reason why he went home. He, on his way back, it may have been that somebody got sick at home, it may have been that there was a plague on the way or something. Anyway, he went home, and on his return trip, in just on the outskirts of Erfurt, where the university was, in Erfurt, that was one of the leading cities. It was the so-called Venice of the North, with all its canals going through it, and 40 monasteries and churches, and a tremendous university established by the humanists. It was the center for the humanists, and this is then where Luther or Martin Luther went to the university, and on his way back to the university he was overcome by a thunderstorm, and it knocked him to the ground, and in his fear, in his need, he called to his patron saint, Saint Anna, which happened to be the mother of the Virgin Mary. Heilige Anna, ich will Mönch werden. Saint Anne, I want to become a monk. Now that's, I believe, where we stopped the last time. And then I showed you the pictures in the book of the miners and so on and so forth, of Mansfeld, of his father's house, the castle and the fear of death, and the Nikolai Church and the Lutherhaus in Eisenach and Erfurt, the old university in Erfurt, which is now destroyed and no longer rebuilt, the coat of arms of the humanists, including Melanchthon and Lang, Johann Lang, and so on, the place where he lived as a student, place where he then later begged as a monk, and some of his professors like Jürgen Stutfetter and Bartholomäus von Usingen, and those were his teachers, and they of course taught him the philosophy of the humanists and those of William of Ockham. Now if anybody has any questions, this is not a formal lecture, we're just talking informally here. So if you have any questions, do not hesitate to interrupt me, and otherwise I will go on then with the part two of the book. It is entitled Luther's Monastic and University Life. Does anybody have any questions up to now?
Well, how about that thunderstorm? What happened then?
Well, when the lightning struck and knocked him to the ground, he called to his patron saint and said, I want to become a monk, and therefore he now enters the Augustinian monastery in Erfurt. Now this Augustinian monastery is one of the very strict kind, where you really had to toe the line and pray for hours at a time and fast for hours at a time. They had more fasting days than the regular days. And on the fasting days, all they got was bread and water. And they had to beg for alms, which actually this was a very rich monastery. They had lots of land. They had lots of money. But this was a sort of discipline, to discipline these monks to be humble and to be pious. They, of course, had to take the vows, the traditional vows of chastity, obedience, and poverty, and Luther did that also. I'd like to read a little bit about where the lightning struck. Luther had hardly completed his examination for the master's degree in the beginning of February 1505 and begun to study law in May according to the wishes of his father when he went home to his parents in Mansfeld about the 20th of June 1505. We don't know why he left for home in the middle of the semester. Upon his return to the university, he was caught in a thunderstorm on July 2nd near Stotternheim. Now that's a small farming community not too far from Erfurt, a village located about 4 miles north of Erfurt. A bolt of lightning struck so close to him that he was thrown to the ground. Seized with fear, Luther called to the patron saint for such a case, "Help me, Saint Anne, I will become a monk." This event was the catalyst for Luther's entry into the monastery. We don't know the cause that drove him to monastic life. Perhaps the philosophy of Ockhamism, could have played a role here, for it, to be sure, emphasized God's absolute power, majesty, and freedom, but it gives man the freedom of will and the possibility to make himself acceptable and favorable in the eyes of God by doing good works. Now, this is going to play a very important part later on with all these religious controversies, this business of doing good works. Is it necessary to do good works to get salvation? On July 17th, 1505, the gates of the monastery of the Augustinian Order of Hermits closed behind Luther. He had intentionally chosen this branch of the Augustinian Order since it was the strictest among the six monasteries in Erfurt. At first, he was received in the Herberge, or hospice, for guests of the monastery. He became a novice in the beginning of September. During Luther's first period in the monastery, it was a time of reflection and soul searching, not only for him, but also for those in the monastery who wanted to test the seriousness of the one who recently entered his gates. Now, there's some people, they get the idea they want to become a monk, so they try it for a while, you see, and then they decide, oh, that's not the life for him, so they take off again. They only take those individuals who are really serious about these kinds of things, and that's what this stay was for. It was, the gate is here, and immediately next to the gate is a sort of a hotel, if you wish. And that's where they stayed for a while to think about the decision that you have made before you even start seeing the other monks, before you even start entering or participating in the monastic life. Naturally, it was a difficult time for him, even without being subjected to the special kinds of degradation, that is, this beginning time in the monastery. After all, he led the life of a student at the University of Erfurt. They went out and had their beer, they went out and had a good time, and they had their friends and so on. Now, all of a sudden, he is living a life of seclusion, and that is quite difficult. It's like being shut up in a jail, so to speak, and you can only have visitors once in a great while. A year later, Luther took the three monastic vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Thereupon, he prepared himself for ordination to the priesthood, which took place in the cathedral at Erfurt on April 4th, 1507. Now, this cathedral, I was just there recently, and they had a terrible thunderstorm. The entire city became dark, and the lightning struck, and it hit the cathedral, and it went into the mechanism of the bell that made the bell ring, and this Maria Gloriosa, this huge bell, rang for 15 minutes in the city of Erfurt. In other words, if the communists won't ring it or the Germans won't, the heavens will. And it rang for 15 minutes. Just like I rang the bell here a little while. You see, you've got to distinguish between fact and joke. That was a joke, you see. Where was I? What's that?
Is it forbidden to ring it there?
Well, you know that most of these cathedrals are run by the state, because there's a separation between church and state. If the members can afford to fix up the church, maintain it, pay its ministers, then by all means, ring the bell. But if you can't, if it's a historical monument, then the state will take it over, maintain it, and naturally they'll ring the bell too when they feel like it. Luther invited his father to the celebration for his first mass. Now he became a priest, which took place in the monastery church on Sunday, May 2nd, 1507. Luther's father came, although he still did not agree with the steps his son had taken. He was reconciled to his son. With a heavy heart, he accepted Martin's new station in life at that time. Now his father believed very heavily in the Tenth Commandment, thou shalt honor father and mother. And this also lay heavily upon Luther's mind that bothered him a long, long time, long after he translated the Bible, and so on and so forth, until he was almost, until 1525 when he got married. All this time it bothered him that he had broken his father's commandment that he should become a lawyer and not go into the monastery and become a monk. Luther now had to turn to the study of theology. Together with his friend and fellow monk, John Lang, he completed the studies, which included not only those at the university, in other words, he took classes at the university, but also the so-called general studies of his order, that is the Augustinian Order of Hermits. They had certain courses that he had to take in the monastery. Now, too, Luther remained within the sphere of Occamistic influence. That is, you have the will to do good works. You have that choice. You have that freedom. And when you do good works, apparently you are pleasing God, and apparently you're going to get salvation. But then there are some other questions that came in, such as predestination and so on. Are you really predestined to become, to get and salvation? Or aren't you one of the chosen ones? And if that's the case, then you're in real trouble. 1508, Martin Luther received the directive to take over the professorship in moral philosophy in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Wittenberg. In other words, he was a monk, and now he received the directive, we need a professor over here. There's a new university being started in a small village called Wittenberg, which actually means Weißerberg, or White Hill, White Mountain. All it was a little hill of sand, that's all it was, on the banks of the Elbe River, not too far from Berlin, south of Berlin. And here this prince of Saxony wanted to establish a university there. That was his seat. And he wanted this little hill, this little village of mud and sticks to become a new Athens. And so he, first of all, built up the castle, and with it the castle church, which was established around 1500 to the turn or so, and then a university, and fixed everything up with marble and sculpture and beautiful metalwork and so on. He wanted this to become another Athens of the North. And so Luther was directed to teach theology there. The university had been founded by the Elector of Saxony, Frederick the Wise, in 1502. Its first rector or president was Pollich von Mellerstadt. That is, the rector is the president. He was professor of medicine and at the same time was the personal physician and elector, and later was active in the colleges of law and theology. In other words, this president not only was professor of medicine, but also the personal physician of the elector. He had all kinds of things to do. Frederick obtained for the College of Theology John Staupitz. Now, he was the general vicar of all the Augustinian monasteries in Germany. He was the general vicar of Saxon congregation of the Augustinian Order of Hermits, and at a later date, Frederick the Wise obtained the professor at Erfurt, Jodocus Trutvetter, from whom we spoke before, Andreas Karlstadt, who later becomes important as one of the radicals, and Luther's close friend, Nicholas von Amstor. And he remained true to Luther's side his entire life. It is surprising that a university was established in a town with a population of a mere 2,000 inhabitants, where Erfurt was a city of about 20,000 inhabitants, so you can see the difference. Luther said later that the people in Wittenberg were located at the very edge of civilization. Nonetheless, in the rural electoral Saxony, Wittenberg was a comparatively strong fortress at the Elbe River and situated at the crossroads of two important commercial routes, so that it became and was an important community. Besides, Wittenberg and its surrounding area enjoyed electoral dignity by virtue of being under the sovereignty of the Saxon elector. In other words, the elector of Saxony was one of the seven who elected the king, who later became then the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And that becomes important then, because now we get the wheeling and dealing of the Pope and the emperor and the elector of Saxony, and that's one of the reasons Luther was not burned at the stake and gone by the wayside like all the rest of them, because he was protected by his electoral prince and benefactor. Finally, Elector Frederick wanted to have a university in his territory because the University of Leipzig became part of Ducal Saxony. Now you have the Electoral Saxony and you have Ducal Saxony. And they were at rivals. Huh? One was to remain Catholic and the other one, the Electoral Saxony, became then evangelical or Protestant. In other words, they couldn't stand one another. When Saxony was divided into the Albertan or the Ducal Saxony and Ernestine, Electoral Saxony in 1458. Frederick loved his newly founded university very much, even if it appeared quite primitive from the beginning. There were hardly more than 300 students in the city when Luther arrived in the winter of 1508. When in subsequent years the reformers attracted many pupils to Wittenberg, consideration for the university played a definite role in the protection of Luther by the sovereign of Electoral Saxony. In other words, the elector wanted to keep Luther on the faculty because he was a very good teacher, was a fine theologian. Huh? If he would have given him up into the hands of the emperor, into the hands of the Catholics, then of course it would have been the end of Luther's efforts to reform the church. Probably for economic reasons, 12 of the 22 professors at the university were paid by the benefice of All Saints Foundation, to which belonged the reconstructed Castle Church with its gigantic relic collection. Now, the Castle Church was the private domain, so to speak, of the Elector of Saxony. He had over 5,000 relics, religious relics. You know what that is? A hair from the Virgin Mary, or a bone from St. Peter, or a piece of wood from the cross, or a nail from the cross. All these kinds of things, over 5,000 of them. He collected them, of course, paid for them. And then the people would come, look at them, and they would give alms. And with the source of this income, the faculty was paid. This was a kind of an economic system. And, you know, when you want to build a church, all you do is you take some blood and pour it over and say, this is the blood of Christ. And then the people come from all over to want to see the blood of Christ. As a matter of fact, they have the virgin's milk in Rome. They got it all stacked up there. That's right. And all these other kinds of things. And people come from miles to see that and pay homage and then so on and so forth. And that's the way it worked. This was displayed from time to time, that is, these relics, they were displayed from time to time, and Frederick had invested heavily in it. In other words, you have to pay for these relics. I mean, you just don't get a piece from the original cross for nothing. I mean, you better pay. It may have come from the nearby woods, but you still have to pay. Three professorships were needed to be filled at the university by two monasteries in Wittenberg. One was filled by the Franciscan monastery, and the other two by the so-called Black Monastery of the Augustinian Order of Hermits. Now, Luther was an Augustinian monk. They wore black outfits. Now, when you see Wes running around here with a brown outfit, that is the order of the Franciscan. They wore brown. Luther wore black. I recommend very highly that Wes dip this thing in a bottle of ink or something, get it black, and then he would look more like Martin Luther rather than some Franciscan running around. More correctly, it should be called the Monastery of the Black Monks. because they wore black habits on the streets. That's just what I got through saying. They wore black habits and not brown or some other color. Of the two professorships available at the Black Monastery, one was filled by Luther as professor of moral philosophy, and the other by the position of professor of Bible in the College of Theology. This post had been filled by John Staupitz, who was the general vicar. Now, he had a lot of work to do, running around, inspecting monasteries and so on, so he didn't have much time to spend in the classroom and teach theology. But he was not able to complete his duties of lecturing because he was overloaded with assignments from his order, that is, John Staupitz. A more intimate connection between Luther and Staupitz probably did not exist as yet at that time. Luther had a considerable amount of work in Wittenberg. He had to give lectures, lead student debates, and carry on his studies, carry on his duties of his order. For example, inspecting and visiting 11 monasteries. That's what Luther had to do. Besides all of this, he continued his education in theology. Any questions up to now? Is this boring or what? Not boring.
Very interesting.
Is it interesting? If it's not interesting, I'll stop. I'll tell you jokes or something. I'll tell you about the Mississippi River. How brown it is, so that the catfish are in there, and these kinds of things. You don't want to hear about that. Shall we go on with Luther?
Yes.
All right. Luther returned to Erfurt in 1509 and began to give theological lectures to a few fellow monks. Why did he return? Well, he was sent there. When you're a monk, you do as you're told. Poverty, chastity, and obedience. Okay, so return to Erfurt, away you go. These lectures were based on the sentences by Peter Lombard. Now, who's Peter Lombard? Well, he lived around 1100 to 1160, and he wrote Sententiarum Libri Quattro, a dogmatic work by the 12th century Parisian bishop. These sentences had been used for centuries as the basic text for lectures in theology. Luther's marginal notes in these copies, which he used for the preparation of his lectures, have been preserved and give us an opportunity to look over the shoulders of this young professor as he worked diligently, intensely, and critically. He also studied the writings of the 5th century church father, Augustine of Hippo, that is, St. Augustine, who was to become important in his own theological development. Besides that, he began to learn Hebrew. But the result of this study was minimal, since Reuchlin's grammar, this is Jean Reuchlin, this famous Hebrew scholar, Reuchlin's text on the language wasn't very good. It was quite insufficient. We don't know when Luther began to occupy himself with the Greek language. We also don't know when he went to Rome. We know it's either 1510 or 1511. We still don't know exactly when. Luther's trip to Rome took place during this time in Erfurt. The exact date is not definitely known. Did the trip occur in the winter of 1510 or 11, or did it occur a year later? The cause was a controversial question of organization within Luther's order, behind which, however, lay theological motives. The final decision was to be made by the general prior of the order. Of the two monks who had to journey to Rome, Luther, the 27 or 28-year-old, was perhaps only the guide, that is, the associate of the man in charge of that mission. Luther was certainly happy to make the trip, aside from the fact that he had taken the vow of obedience. He had the opportunity to make general confessions at sacred shrines in Rome and to obtain indulgences which were readily available en route to Rome. Yet, it is informative that with his intensive search for salvation, his eyes were closed to the corruption of the church, which often enough came to light at that time in Rome. In other words, when he went to Rome, he accepted all these things that were going on in Rome, all this corruption. Not until later, as he recalled many of these experiences, did he recognize the meanings to which he had at first been blind. In other words, later, when he returned to Wittenberg, then he started thinking about this, and then it became and occurred to him that this was utter corruption of the Church of Rome. Perhaps the trip to Rome had a meaning for his spiritual development, in that it failed to quiet his demands to be freed from the misery within him. Luther's stay in a monastery was with great inner distress. Perhaps it originally driven him into monastic life. Certainly he did not constantly live under the strain, but did endure moments of terrible agony. We do know precisely what his torments were, though Luther described them to us in his Resolutions or Explanations of the 95 Theses, written in 1518 to clarify the 95 Theses as follows. Now this, he now describes his inner distress in the monastery. I myself knew a man, that is in quote, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 2, who claimed they had often suffered these punishments. In fact, over a very brief period of time. Yet they were so great and so much like hell that no tongue could adequately express them, no pen could describe them, and one who had not himself experienced them could not believe them. And so great were they that, if they had been sustained or had lasted for half an hour, even for one-tenth of an hour, he would have perished completely and all of his bones would have been reduced to ashes. At such a time, God seems terribly angry, and with him, all of creation. At such a time, there is no flight, no comfort, within or without, but all things accuse. At such a time as that, the psalmist mourns, quote, I am cut off from thy sight. Or at least, he does not dare to say, quote, O Lord, do not chasten me in thy wrath. In the moment, strange to say, the soul cannot believe that it can be, that it can ever be redeemed, or other than that the punishment is not yet completely felt. Yet the soul is eternal and is not able to think of itself of being temporal. All that remains is the stark, naked desire for help and a terrible groaning, but it does not know where to turn for help. In this instance, the person is stretched out with Christ so that all his bones may be counted, and every corner of the soul is filled with the greatest bitterness, dread, trembling, and sorrow in such a manner that all these last forever. That is from Luther's works, volume 31. It is certain that his spiritual exercise in the monastery did not give him peace of mind. Occamism enhanced greatly his fear of being cast aside by God. God in his majesty had the freedom through his omnipotence to choose man for salvation or cast him to damnation. Luther had for a time the mortal fear of being one of those condemned. And precisely this worry was to him a sign of his condemnation. After all, the teachings of Occam about man said that he can do something with his inherent strength. He only has to do that which is within him, and he can do a great deal. He can bring himself to complete remorse about his sins, and in that way prepare himself for grace, and finally make himself worthy of acceptance. But how is this possible? Even if the experience belies such perfection. Luther was under no illusion here. He extracted the last results of the claim of perfect love of God, which he had gotten to know from the works of St. Augustine. That is something about his inner distress of the life in the monastery. And now, in 1512, he goes back to Wittenberg. These inner needs of Luther, called his cloister struggle, also continued when he moved again from Erfurt to Wittenberg. This move to Wittenberg was prompted by the continuing arguments among his fellow monks in the Erfurt Monastery, which precipitated Luther's journey to Rome. At this time, his old friend and fellow monk, John Lang, also went to Wittenberg, and Heinrich Böhmer, an important German Luther scholar during the first quarter of this century, believes one may recognize the hidden ways of God in this change of scene. For in this manner, Luther came into more intimate contact with Staupitz, and thereby Wittenberg, and not Erfurt, became the stage for the Reformation. And that was important, because Erfurt was in the territory of the Archbishop of Magdeburg, where Luther would have never found protection. The Elector Saxony, however, had a certain free hand for various reasons. So that the professorship of the Old and New Testament of Staupitz could be turned over to Luther, it was necessary for him to earn a doctor's degree. He obtained the degree on October 19, 1512, by participating in a theological debate. The fee, 17 gulden, which had to be paid, in order to get the doctor's degree, was contributed by the elector upon the advice and request of John Staupitz. Now here you have an elector of Saxony. He's supporting this monk, this professor at his university, and yet they never met one another. They have never come face to face. It was always done through a writer, through a lawyer, through the vicar, it's always through somebody else. This, I think, is very, very interesting.
They never ever met?
Never met. They never met one another.
I wonder if they liked each other.
What?
I wonder if they would have liked each other if they had.
Well, I think so. I think so. The way that Elector of Saxony supported Luther, gave him a home, gave him presents for his wedding, and gave him this and gave him that. I mean, it's kind of nice. Wish somebody give me a home. I keep singing that song all the time. Give me a home with a buffalo rope. Haven't got one yet. I guess I don't know the right elector. What's that? You bet. She gives me a lot of things. Cold shoulder and I don't know what else. I like that. Hot tongue and lots of things. It's excellent with mustard. About this time, at the latest, the event which actually made Luther the reformer occurred. Now we're going to the Tower Experience. Some of you people were asking about the Tower Experience. Is that right? Or are all you people new here? So that ought to be exciting to you. It's not exciting?
Try it.
Oh, I'll try it. It is designated as Luther's Tower Experience because it took place, according to Luther, in the Tower of the Black Monastery. Now, when you open the book and look at Luther's house here, you will see a tower in there. That's not the tower in which Luther had the Tower Experience. That tower in which he had the Tower Experience was torn down. I was trying to get another T in there, but it didn't work. Trying to give you a lot of alliteration there. The tower that you see there is merely a staircase that leads up to the various floors, okay? In those days, in the 16th century, they always built the staircase on the outside. I don't know why. Does anybody know why? I guess it was easier to build outside than it was inside or something, I don't know. It took place, according to Luther, in the Tower of the Black Monastery. Luther was given permission to occupy the only heated room in the monastery. That tower no longer exists today. We don't know the exact date when the Tower Experience took place. We only know its contents. Luther reflected and meditated on chapter 1 of the letter of Paul to the Romans, verse 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith. To the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith, as it is written. He who through faith is righteous shall live. It occurred to Luther that the righteousness of God, which is discussed in this chapter, was not to be understood as a characteristic of God, which must set us in terror and fear, but on the contrary, the righteousness of God is to be considered as a gift which God has presented to us contrary to our merit, based on the deliverance through Jesus Christ. This realization of righteousness as a gift of God, as in the final analysis, is in the final analysis an exegetical one, knowledge, which comes to a scholar carefully studying the Holy Scripture. But Luther accepted this discovery not only intellectually, but rather with every fiber of his being. It became the foundation of his life. Naturally, Luther considered it valid to continue to search for sanctification. But now he took comfort in the realization that forgiveness is assured by the gift of God. He had found the merciful God. The Christian is a sinner in reality. But at the same time, he is righteous by the mercy of God through faith in Jesus Christ. Here we stand before Luther's paradoxical anthropology, that man is at the same time righteous and a sinner. Simul justus, simul peccator. Naturally, the prerequisites for Luther's enlightenment were in the volumes he had read, as for example, in the works of St. Augustine and the mystics, which Luther, however, had read in an uncritical manner. Contemporaries had also contributed to the discovery Luther made in the tower, namely by conversations with von Staupitz and Lang and so on and so forth. Luther recognized with gratitude that John Staupitz had helped him spiritually. But above all, the Holy Scriptures, in particular the letters of Paul, were decisive in the discovery in the tower. What now followed was basically only the consequence of this rediscovery of the gospel. It permitted Luther to become first a critic of his church. And because his church did not respond to this criticism, a new confession, namely the Lutheran Church, originated. This course of events distinguishes Luther from the other reformers before him. And now we then talk about indulgence traffic for the construction of St. Peter's Church in Rome. Does anybody have any questions up to now? In a little while, I can show you some pictures.
Is your experience the same as Eric Erickson's in his famous book, Young Man Luther? He says that John Stoffus was the only Catholic monk, teacher, official that Luther spoke kindly of after his getting out of the Catholic Church. Is that a fair statement in your experience?
They were all Catholics at that time.
No, that's not the way I wanted to phrase it. Eric Erickson in his book said that Luther spoke so harshly of most of his former Catholic associates, but he never spoke harshly of John Stoffitz.
Well, he loved the guy.
Yes, that he was the only one that he did speak kindly of and loved him to the end of his life, the way Erickson expressed it. He also said that he's the only man that made Martin Luther laugh when he was a young monk.
That could very well be, because when I think of his other colleagues, there were professors, there were fellow students, and so on. Yes, that's right, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
I would
think
so. It may not
be
an important point, but I just...
Well, yes, because Luther often went to him when he had this inner distress, this cloister struggle, and talked to him length on end. Mm-hmm. They were close friends.
Do the Catholic monks now, in this age, do they have the same seclusion, and do they go through all that too?
Oh yes, oh yes.
They have the same,
this is tradition.
Are they as restricted?
Yes, they are restricted. For example, where I take my students in Passau, which is located on the border between Austria and Czechoslovakia on the Danube on the way to Vienna. There is a Goethe Institute where I take my students and they study 4 weeks there after we have a 2-week tour through East and West Germany. There's a monastery high up on the hill, and those monks are secluded. You don't see the monks, and they have very little contact with the outside world. I was lucky. I got to see one little monk, and he was working in the garden there, and I want to take some photographs. But you don't see the others. They are in strict seclusion, and it depends, of course, upon the order. Some will not speak to you, or let alone to anybody else, and so on. It depends upon the order. But yes, monastic life is a shut-off life. It's a secluded life. It has nothing to do with the outside world. That's right.
The reason I ask, I have a distant relative who is becoming a monk. And I was just kind of wondering about that.
Yes.
It's interesting to hear what Martin Luther had to go through.
Oh, yes. And he had the bell would ring, say, at 2 in the morning, and then you go down and pray for an hour or two. And then you go back to bed for a while, and then your bell will ring again, and you go pray some more. And then you go into a room, and there you have to sit, and you have to confess everything to the vicar of that particular order. And if you don't confess, well, then you get punished physically, too. And if you're caught speaking, and if you're caught not walking the right way with your head down, if you're caught speaking when you're not supposed to speak, those are all punishment. Those are all crimes which have to be dealt with, either physical punishment or scrub floors or something. That's right. They had very strict orders.
Well, this is in Europe, though. Does that happen here in the United States, too?
Well, I presume it does, yes, because the tradition is maintained if you belong to a certain order, I would think, don't you?
I don't think there are as many in the United States that are that way.
What?
I don't think there are as many in the United States that are so strict.
That's probably right.
I think the majority of them
probably are right. There's probably more contact with the outside world, yes.
Even to women.
Yes.
Because I've spent time in
convents and so on, yes. Mm.
There's a brand new book by Henry Nouwen called The Genesee Diary, which recounts his 7 months in a Trappist monastery in New York.
Yeah.
A very enlightening view of modern day.
Yes. Yes.
And I think Trappists are some of the most strict in the United States now.
And this book shows that they're very open and very gracious and have gotten a lot of mercy from Lutherans.
I haven't visited any monasteries or convents in the United States. I visited a few over there, particularly in southern Germany. They're quite prevalent. The ones in Czechoslovakia have all been eliminated by the state, and there were some beautiful monasteries in Prague, but they have all, because their land has been taken away, and if they don't have the land for certain orders, they cannot make a living, so they move out of the country. So I've been dispersed. In 1514, the Pope issued a bull calling for the renewed sale of indulgences to benefit the construction of St. Peter's Church in Rome. The sale would also aid the Archbishop of Mainz, a certain Albert of Hohenzollern. This prince had obtained a high office in the church long before attaining the required minimal age, and in addition, now held three ecclesiastical offices. First place, he had to be of the right age, which he wasn't. Second of all, he held three offices, ecclesiastical offices. He could only hold one. Well, he can do all those things if you pay for it. Whom do you pay? The church in Rome. And it cost money. Now he needed money. So now he makes a deal to get money. How does he do it? He sells indulgences, which according to canon law was also illegal, that is, holding these three ecclesiastical offices. Consequently, the archbishop had to secure special papal dispensation, for which he had to pay a considerable amount of money to the curia in Rome. Archbishop Albert had borrowed the necessary money from the financial solvent banking house of the Fuggers in Augsburg. Now the Fuggers, they were, well, it's like a big bank. They had lots of money. They loaned it to anybody that needed, including emperors and kings and archbishops and dukes and anybody that needs it. Loan them the money.
First Rothschild.
That's right. Who, in order to guarantee the repayment of the loan, had to arrange with Pope Leo X for the sale of indulgence with part of the proceeds going to the archbishop. This is how then he got his money back. A letter of indulgence guaranteed for the purchaser or for someone who died a reduction of the punishment for his sin as well as the time to be spent in purgatory. Now, indulgences had been going on for a long time. They actually started before the Crusades, but in the 11th and 12th century. If you didn't want to participate in a crusade, you could ask somebody to participate for you, and then you would pay him. That is a way. Why would you participate in a crusade? Well, it is something to please God, something so you won't have to spend so much time in purgatory. Now, purgatory, of course, is a place where you spend some time. It's very hot there, and there you are cleansed of all your sin. The German word for purgatory is Fegefeuer. Feuer is fire. Fegen means to sweep. It sweeps your sins away. No sinner can go into heaven. First you spend time in purgatory, where you are cleansed from your sins, and then you can go to heaven. Besides that, one was able to purchase some relief from the demands of confession and fasting periods. All you got to do is pay, and you can do anything. If the rule is no meat on Friday, all you got to do is pay some money, you can have all the meat you want. Or if the rule is you're supposed to go to church every morning, you pay a little money, you don't have to go to church every morning. Or only when you feel like it. All it takes is money. Sounds like the 20th century. A little bit, doesn't it? Yeah. During the time Luther was in Wittenberg, John Tetzel. Now this Tetzel was born in Pirna, which is near Dresden, and he was now a monk, an unscrupulous Dominican monk from St. Paul's Convent in Leipzig. He's the one that sold these indulgences. As prescribed, a representative of the Fugger Bank traveled with Tetzel. In other words, this banking house didn't trust Tetzel to take in all his money. They sent a representative with him to keep an eye on him. And what they did, this Tetzel, because unscrupulous, they made a great big spectacle out of it. They got all the church flags, and they cut candles and torches, and they got a regular parade going. First, of course, they had a man coming into town announcing, oh, this Tetzel is coming, and now you can pay for your remission of sins and buy letters of indulgence. A big propaganda program. When the day arrived, oh, there was a great parade, and there were drums and pipes and fanfare. And then it was marched into church, and this church had a huge cross with the cross of the papacy and so on and so forth. In other words, there was a lot of pomp and ceremony, and in a great big steel box. And then you would make out these indulgences, letter of indulgence. I got one in here. It's parchment, and it's all nicely handwritten with a nice big seal on it. He didn't want all that money from Saxony going to Rome. He wanted to keep it in Saxony to build up his own territory. After all, the money raised would benefit the Hohenzollerns, and the elector was not interested in abetting the family's rise to power. By Hohenzollerns, I mean the Archbishop of Mainz. He would benefit. Then the Elector of Saxony wanted nothing to do with the Hohenzollerns, with the Elector of Mainz and the Archbishop of Mainz. In spite of the fact that these indulgences were not sold in Wittenberg, devout people from Wittenberg, concerned with the salvation of their souls or that of those who had died, found a way to purchase indulgences. It was only an 18-mile trip from Wittenberg to Jüterbog, and that's where Tetzel was, in another territory where he was permitted to sell these things. Luther learned from his parishioners the terrible consequences of the indulgence traffic. These people would give out their last nickel or their last gulden to buy their way out of purgatory. And then, of course, you have terrible consequences, because then there wouldn't be much food on the table and so on and so forth. In addition, he was bombarded from all sides with oral and written questions about indulgences.